being covered by the Constitution covers. So so those that are mentally deprived of the rights of the Alaska Natives, we may need to have an Inupiaq interpreter for them. And just like we need to interpret the state constitution. And so these guys, I have spent in my lifetime in securing and maintaining these rights in the neighborhood of $15 million for our own protection. And I would like to make another point that the condition of statehood and its boundaries cannot be resolved by the state. Maybe that this race problem that we have in Alaska could be best handled by the esteemed local boundary commission, who is already charged with governmental capacity. And the boundary between the state and the local and the local IRA could be resolved and certified and to be taken to the special master of the Supreme Court for certification for the dismissal of a uniform boundary dispute resolved in 208 communities unilaterally to bring to the special master of the Supreme Court for the resolutions of these interjurisdictional problems. And state of Alaska would become a party because it is a derivative of Congress, that it is not alone. And so that we bring in the parties, then maybe the chance for well-being and good government will have a chance. And so I think that state of Alaska loses for the simple fact that it too has digressed to the multinational mentality, who is not interested in good citizenship, who is not interested in whose plant is questionable. And so this low bidder engineering and planning that we have responsibility for, we're being lost in this. So our experience from the North Slope is that until people, I am not mad at the Anglo-Saxon people, I am mad at their attitudes about us. And so here is, we have given you enough room, enough latitude, yet you are psychologically depraved. You have to prey on somebody. And so this prey, and you view the native as if he is a predator. And so when you are in the Department of Natural, Department of Interior, just like oil and gas, like we are, we view the Anglo-Saxon community probably in the likeness of the Tasmanians of the Australian government.
Well, Charlie, look, I think this is a good time to stop for coffee. And I think that after that, we'll carry on with the agenda. And I'd like to, before we still have an hour left after coffee, and I'd like to deal with the question of the relationship between native governments and ANCSA corporations. I think that's a practical question that has to be addressed. And then I'd like to go back to some of the questions that we were struggling with yesterday about native governments and how they would really work. So let's take a break for coffee.
Wander over and get me some coffee.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I can stay awake. It's already 8 o'clock my time.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead. Well, let's take our seats, shall we? Let's just pull ourselves together here and well, let's take our seats. I guess everybody's here. Well, I would like to turn now to the question of relationships between native governments and ANCSA corporations, and I'd like to ask Byron Malott to say something about that, and indeed about any of the other matters that have come up, Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Some months ago, but rather recently, I and others had the opportunity to sit down and spend a number of hours with a United States senator who had a significant role in the development and passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And it was something of a session wherein he was padding about in slippers and in his own home and to some degree waxing philosophical about the whole thing. And I thought, you know, gave a perspective, particularly as to his role and to how he saw it, that I think is important for us to hear. He said, you know, as I look at 1991 and the prospect or the possibility that native land could be lost to native people by the sale of native corporation stock, he said, and I'm paraphrasing him, certainly not quoting him, that is very, very disturbing to me, because one of the principal tenets of ANCSA was that what we were trying to forge was not a settlement for a single generation, but a settlement which would allow many generations of Alaska Natives to own and utilize the assets and the proceeds from the settlement. Secondly, the senator said that he had always been troubled since passage of ANCSA by the amount of litigation and legal costs that had been associated in its implementation, and felt very strongly that as those of us involved with the implementation of ANCSA have felt, that certainly that was a debilitating feature of ANCSA during these years, and the senator felt so strongly about it that he said, for example, if he had known that would happen, and he should have because he was a lawyer and it was a very complex act, so forth, that he would have sought vigorously to include a clause such as was in the Trans-Alaska Pipeline Bill, which said you can sue us, but you can sue only on constitutional grounds, and you can only do it within 60 days of passage of this act. Otherwise, we will use other mechanisms to try to deal with the with differences. And I think that this points out in a perception what I want to talk about in the relationship of ANCSA corporations and tribal governments. And that is, it wasn't supposed to be this way. You know, Native people, I believe, felt very strongly that the land and the way it was allocated under ANCSA would remain for the long term in Native ownership. The sense of almost everyone, at least, that I spent time with during those days, and I think that the surprise and the frustration, even as evidenced by a U.S. senator who was close to the process, that somehow it didn't work out that way, demonstrates that clearly, that there was never any real sense that Native people were giving up anything with respect to the ownership of Native land beyond that which was engineered by the Claims Settlement Act itself, and that the land would be maintained in Native ownership. Now, I think one of the things instantly that became a problem was that no one really understood, even those involved in the Congress, with the writing of the act, was how fragile and how dangerous and how risk-laden an institution for land ownership, a business corporation, is. And if, as many say, there were those in Congress and outside it involved with the passage of ANCSA who felt that they were slipping something through so that Native lands could be lost by 1991, I submit that without changes to ANCSA, they could have found no better way. Because in corporations, the land is absolutely at risk. I think that it's been more seriously at risk in the corporate setting than would even be typical in a business corporation in any other setting. Because the purpose of the corporation was to advance the social, economic, cultural interests of Native people in the business setting, that is, in the corporate setting, that is, the taking of an asset, if you want to call the land that, and making it bigger and making it stronger and using it as the basis to advance the interests of a people. Well, I found very vividly and very quickly that we were swimming in shark-infested waters that at the outset looked like a placid pool, and it was not very long before all of the horror stories came about of Native corporations losing money in business enterprises. And I don't want to go into that in any detail other than to say the increase in the risk came from the, I'm not sure it was explicit. It was explicit in some way, but there's no question that it was absolutely implicit that these corporations were to, as I said, advance the interests of Native people in a whole range of ways. And many corporate leaders took that to heart, both at the village and at the regional level. And many of the investments were made, some say imprudently, largely because the corporations wanted to do exactly that, advance the social, economic, cultural aspirations of the shareholders that they represented. And so you have the stories of the oil refineries in Fairbanks, which caused the corporation huge losses, which evolved from the simple proposition placed before that board of directors and which grew therefrom, the simple proposition that we ought to try to get into a business wherein we can reduce fuel costs to the people up and down the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers by somehow getting oil and refining it and selling it in a way that our people will benefit. Well, last year a Native corporation wrote off $18 million based on that simple business premise. And so one of the assumptions that I use as I look at ANCSA corporations and tribal governments is from a firm fixation with the overwhelming reality of what it takes to make a business corporation work. It is an all-consuming effort. It requires the kind of focus on business that virtually precludes a focus on other things that really are important. Because if for 1 minute you take your mind off the business, all sorts of things begin to go awry because your competitors ain't doing the same thing. And I, having lived in that circumstance, I just can't emphasize it enough. And I know that many who have never experienced say, why is he making such a big point of that? All I can say is that it is very, very real. And what it has done, of course, is in the corporate structure, to some degree, co-opted a whole generation of Native leadership, which otherwise would have been involved dealing with Native issues in a different way. But I certainly can be challenged on this, but I don't think that village people at the time, I don't think that the significant number of Native people who were involved with the development of ANCSA at the time, and again, to get back to the surprise and the frustration of one of the key senators involved, and even, I think, to offer, I think, some firm evidence of this, even the inclusion in the act itself of a section which precluded political activity and the use of ANCSA proceeds for partisan political purposes, which was included in the act, to me means that everybody looked at this positively. No one really looked at the downside risks. The politicians thought that these people were going to be off and running, they were going to be doing all sorts of incredible things for their people, and one of the things we ought to watch out for is that they don't use that power in a political way to our disadvantage. It's something of a vignette, but I think that it demonstrates that there was a strong sense that what was being created were institutions that would be very positive, powerful forces for Native people. The reality has been very different. And the other thing I think that Native people felt at the time, and it's been said here several ways by some of the participants, is that Native people did not believe that they were giving up rights that they had as Native people. And that if there had been any strong understanding or sense that at 1991, Natives would not be in full and absolute control of their destiny, I think Native people would have told the federal government to go jump, and Congress to go jump straight in the lake. And having said all that, you know, we deal with a certain reality today that that requires a whole lot of work and which has prompted, among other things, the sort of inquiry that certainly you are about, Justice Berger. And even with the importance of the issue, we're still the same people. And whether you're a corporate leader or a tribal leader or a nonprofit leader or a village leader, we're all Native people, and I think that that is the fundamental strength that we've got to build on. And as I look at the relationship between tribal government and ANCSA corporations, and from my experience with ANCSA corporations, I think that it is a resolvable issue, but that it will be resolved probably on several different levels, that the way villages deal with it will be different to some degree from the way regions deal with it. That there will be mechanisms that we can use without any change, legislative change to ANCSA, and that there may be a number of responses that require further action by Congress. But as we look at the land right now and its relationship with tribal government, I think that what Native people need more than anything else is a moral imperative to deal with it. That is, if a people said, as corporate shareholders, we want that land protected, then as shareholders of the corporation, voting as shareholders but thinking as Native people, they could do that. Even now. The question, of course, then, is what sort of institution becomes the repository? And that is one of the important issues that is being addressed. The longer we wait, and even now, that simple proposition becomes and is very difficult because of continuing and increasing encumbrances on that land as it remains in corporate ownership, the pledging of land assets for business purposes to financial institutions, so forth. Those issues do become very real. The issues of lands that the Native corporations have leased for development purposes. But even in light of all that, I think that the significant corpus of that 44 million acres is still freely available for Native people to do what they will with it. And I think that that's been one of the remarkable positive features of ANCSA, is that for all of the negative that has evolved around the operation of Native corporations, almost to a corporation, there has been a strong underlying sense that we've got to hang on to the land. And while there have been a number of corporations that have sold land, that have divested themselves of certain amounts of land, in the aggregate, that is very, very small. And I know, for example, from my own corporate experience and from talking with a lot of other corporate, a lot of other Native folks who are involved with these corporations, that they'd walk a country mile and do all sorts of things to avoid having to pledge ANCSA assets in the conduct of their business enterprise. So I think that the fact that some 12, 13 years later, that land is in the main, in the significant main, still freely unencumbered in native hands in the amounts of tens of millions of acres is something that you know, is very positive as we look to how to deal with this question of where do we ultimately put native land so that it remains in native ownership and in some kind of status that recognizes native ethnicity. And as we look to the kinds of structural changes and organizations that we have in order to accomplish that. It's been somewhat intriguing to me as I've looked at my own experience and the experience of others, and as I've sat through this meeting, certainly no others like it, but at least other kinds of meetings. You know, I was just recently asked to serve on the board of directors of a lower 48 tribal corporation, tribally created corporation, the purpose of which was to try to take certain tribal assets and use them for economic purposes outside the political purview of the tribal government. And we've had some conversation about that at this meeting, and it's somewhat ironic that to some degree we're on the other side of that. We have the economic institutions, and we're saying to ourselves as a people on a statewide basis, how do we get those assets much more tribally oriented? And I expect that that a balance is possible. As you talk about government and how government fits here, you know, it seems to me that at the outset and in its framing, that also has got to transcend detail. That it's that somehow people are able to articulate very clearly and forcefully and responsibly that I'm sorry, what we have doesn't work because it doesn't recognize our existence as a people. And you know, when you talk about forms of government at the state level, that is a rub that comes instantly, particularly when you talk about municipal government. And while local forms of municipal government can serve various functions, when you spend a lot of time talking about those forms, in my judgment, you're really not addressing the real issue. And the real issue is that government, more than anything else, and I think it was said here earlier, is a system of values. And it's how society expresses those values. And what native people in Alaska are saying, particularly those who live at the village level and who are closest to the living culture and are the living culture, they're saying those values frighten us. And somehow we've got to forge a different relationship than exists now. We hear it expressed in education. We hear it expressed in the management of fish and game. And ultimately, we hear it expressed in how Native people own and control their own land asset. They're saying that the institutions that exist, in which we have dealt with over some period of time, really aren't working. And so to me, it becomes a very large public policy question, and it can be addressed several ways. You know, and I think that one of the most significant ways that it can be addressed is what, and I'm anxious to hear his further clarification, but also to take advantage of the pipe stem doctrine. But what the people of Akiachuk have done, you know, in a very methodical, straightforward, responsible, quiet sort of way, they said, we're going to redefine our relationship so that it makes sense to us. We'll worry about some of the niceties later. And while this may create worlds of work for lawyers over time, you know, if a people thinks that that sort of, that they've come to the point where that sort of action is necessary, and if they don't take it, they have not assumed the moral imperative, and these people have. And whether or not that is something that can be engendered on a statewide basis or is even necessary on a statewide basis, I don't know, because one of the other things we need to recognize is that circumstances do vary around the state, and the hard realities and the hard practicalities may require different responses in other circumstances. But as one corporate leader and as an individual native, I think that as I look to what I believe Native people wanted and expected and thought they were getting at the time of ANCSA with respect to the future of their lands, and where I see us now, that I think that there is a real need to restructure the relationship between ANCSA corporations and the tribe, in each instance, however that is defined, so that that land really can be protected for the long-term ownership of Alaska's Native people, or it will be within not a generation, but in many instances, a matter of decades, irrevocably lost. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Byron. I'm going to take the liberty of using my position as chairman to invite Tim Coulter to speak now. He has to leave tonight, and I'd like his thoughts. I think they follow on from Byron's about if we're talking about the tribe, Native people, what kind of institutions will serve them best. So, Tim, you have the floor.
Yes, the things that I have to say follow very nicely. In fact, you said some of what I was thinking much better than I had been able to articulate it. I think the question is exactly as you put it. The question is one of adjusting, arranging, and rearranging the relationship between the Native peoples and others. And I feel more comfortable saying Native people. Some are tribes, some are not. I'm not quite sure what term to use, but when I say Native peoples, I mean all. I am not really able to propose specific kinds of solutions or suggestions, because I think really there are many, many kinds of solutions and suggestions that people can select from in their particular case so that their needs are best served. But I have tried to write down a short list of elements which I think must be a part of any alternative that would be useful or proper. Let me show you what I mean. Number one, I think that any kind of alternative to ANCSA, any kind of alternative to the relations that exist, must be an alternative that Native people consent to. First of all, and really consent to, not where just some leaders, no matter how wonderful and well-intentioned they may be, but where the people whose lands and resources and lives that are involved, they themselves actually consent. And that furthermore, whatever alternative is put forward must be one that cannot later be changed without that same kind of consent. And let me add that it may not be a consent that's just a simple majority. I don't know how people here feel, but many times where something will fundamentally affect the whole community forever, people feel that it's not proper that 51% should be able to determine such a thing. Maybe it should be consensus, or maybe it should be a supermajority, the way Western European democracies work. Fundamental questions require a lot of people to agree on it. Well, that's one thing, and I think alternatives that don't include ironclad provisions for consent should probably be rejected out of hand. Third, I think that solutions that do not provide for local options and choices and selections are probably inappropriate. Blank, and countless people have said this in the 2 days that I've been here, that whatever alternatives are put forward must be alternatives where each village, each region, each people, each community can decide for itself what it wants. Number three, I think that any kind of alternative, any solution or anything that we hope would be a solution, must include some kind of provision such that there are either absolute or constitutional limits on the power of the United States government to change it or affect it. It just is not going to be very useful to come up with some solution which Congress could legislate away a generation from now, or which, even more likely, the Supreme Court could decide away at the stroke of a pen. Unfortunately, sovereign immunity is like that. And David's paper, I think, is nicely reasoned, but one of the things about trying to live within the existing body of court-created law is that those nine justices up there can and do change it every year, just like this. They write off one right after another. So that I think solutions and alternatives have to be ones where there are real and predictable limits on the power of the federal government or any other government to change it without the consent of native people. Now, very closely related is number four. Any kind of alternative or solution must be one which can be legally enforced against the United States or the state of Alaska or other people. Unfortunately, there are a good many so-called Indian rights today that exist only at the sufferance of the federal government. They can't actually be enforced against Congress if Congress chooses to take them away. And if you come up with solutions or so-called solutions up here to the ANCSA problem which fail to take that into account and do something about it, well, you may have accomplished something, but you've still got a problem. So, number five, I think that whatever is done, and this may be the most important, whatever is done to change ANCSA and to change these relations, it must be done under conditions of basic fairness, conditions which are perceived to be basically fair and without any kind of real duress. Because if people in the villages, if native people have to make choices under a threat, as has been the case uniformly, well, this is the best you're going to get if you don't accept this kind of proposition, you risk losing everything. Well, that is not a condition of basic fairness, because choices made under those conditions are ones that are not going to last. The next generation is going to come along and they're going to say, that was no good, we never agreed to it, and those who pretended to agree to it were acting in a way that there were conditions of fundamental unfairness, and to come up with some other settlement that is fundamentally unfair is just going to be a waste of time. If you have to do it, okay, make the best of it, but your kids are going to be working on it again in another 25 or 30 years or whatever. Sometimes external supervision or oversight can be a help. My original note here said perhaps there should be international supervision of any readjustment of the relationship, because in the case of instances like, well, let me not say Greenland because I don't know enough about it, but where other peoples readjust their relationship with colonial powers or former colonial powers, it is often and usually done under some form of international supervision, which helps to assure that the conditions are sort of fair and that people are acting sort of in good faith and not trying to take advantage the weak against the strong against the weak and so on. Maybe it need not be international supervision, but there could be other mechanisms for bringing in some other disinterested party to help oversee readjustments of this relationship so that the strong don't attempt to take advantage of the weak. Number six, I think there would have to be provision to assure, and this may be repetitive, but excuse me if it is, but there must be some kind of provision in any alternative for ongoing, that is permanent, native control over the native communities and resources. A solution isn't going to work if somehow native control over the resources in the communities is somehow not made permanent. Doesn't need to be discussed, I think. Number seven, and I think this may be the most practical, it's the last one. Number seven, I think that what needs to be done in a practical way is to remove impediments that now exist in the legislation to the use of all proper and honest legal mechanisms for doing what the people at the village level want to do. The situation of the people at Akyachuk and the Yupik Nation is a pretty good example. They're trying to do something that they clearly perceive they wish to do, and they're beset with 1,000 technicalities of state and federal law that seem to make it impossible for them to do simple things for the welfare of their community. If the impediments continue to exist, if people are not free to use honest and proper legal mechanisms to adjust their relationship, how can it be a fair and proper resolution? Well, I think getting out of the ANCSA problem is a matter of using many, many legal mechanisms and legal options. There isn't in any, as far as I can see, there isn't any one solution at all. There is a shelf that's filled with dozens of kinds of perfectly useful legal mechanisms, legal things like corporations, cooperatives, nonprofits, municipal governments, IRA governments, traditional governments. There are all kinds of things that people could use so that they can run their lives the way they want to. And what's needed is for people to be able to use them as they wish to do what they want in their community. In many cases, I think it may be necessary to get Congress to pass new legislation to get what is needed. But legislation and getting a new law passed by Congress, that's just one more legal tool to use. That's just one other thing, like setting up a corporation or like creating a IRA government. It's just another legal mechanism that Native people can and certainly may want to use. Particularly, and I think it's probably unavoidable, that legislation, new legislation by Congress, is going to be needed to deal with the problem of taxation of the land and resources, and to deal with, I think it probably should be looked at to deal with the problem of the of sovereign immunity. I think the immunity of Native governments from suit is very shaky right now with this present Supreme Court and what some of the lower courts have been doing. If you're not careful, the Supreme Court with one stroke of the pen is going to say that Native governments can be sued for all they're worth. And that might be changed with an act of Congress. Something's going to need to be done about the problem of adverse possession, where somebody moves onto your land and just sits there long enough that they can claim it for themselves. You see, even if the native villages acquire that land in their own name, they're not going to have the protection of the Non-Intercourse Act and all these other doctrines. At least this is the way I'm presently seeing it. I hope people will correct me. They're still going to be subject to taxation, adverse possession if trespassers move on. They can still be, they still might lose it in other ways. Probably legislation is needed if a village wants to protect itself from losing the land in those ways. Well, that being the case, if legislation is going to have to come about, it seems to me that people ought to consider making out a full shopping list. In other words, go ahead and ask for what you want. Don't try to just settle for the usual things that are handed out with federal Indian law or federal trusteeship. Go ahead and ask for, try to get legislation for exactly what you want. If you want immunity from taxation, have that legislated. I would suggest that's probably just as practical a solution as putting the land in trust, another way of getting tax immunity. If you want other kinds of protections, legislate them specifically rather than relying on the usual conventional concepts of Indian law. And in that regard, I can't end without suggesting that I think the notion and the concept of trusteeship ought to be very carefully examined, because I feel that it's being used to describe many, many things, and it may mean things that are not intended. Federal trusteeship, the trust relationship, means at least these things: the obligation of the federal government to provide programs. Well, unfortunately, that's not really enforceable against Congress. Sometimes people mean trusteeship, or they say trusteeship, when they mean that they want the land held in trust so that it won't be taxed. Well, if that's what you want, you can have that done through specific legislation. In fact, the way it's done in ANCSA, now they legislate specifically that certain of the lands can't be taxed. Sometimes trusteeship is used when people simply want to prevent the land from being alienated or lost. Well, that can be done specifically through legislation as well. Also, sometimes people mean they want trusteeship because they want the Interior Department to help manage the land, or they want the federal government to help them